I'd like to introduce Vicky.
I'm Vicky, I'm an addict. I haven't spoken in a microphone before, so I don't know if everybody can hear. Yeah, it's quite a big meeting, actually. And I guess I was just thinking that you guys were doing the tapes. They seem to go all over the world sometimes to people in treatment centers. And I think I would have probably loved that if I was in a treatment center, getting something from outside, you know. I did actually start this recovery thing in treatment. I didn't like it one bit. Like, I thought I was going to a health farm, and I was going to get, like, a slender tone, and, like, not even have to exercise or sweat or anything, get a manicure. I thought I was going to be just sorted out. I just needed a bit of a change, and it was this treatment center where all these alcoholics were sort of shuffling around the place, and I didn't really like how they had the matching curtains and bedspreads and, you know, the color scheme and all that sort of thing. I thought I was actually really well. So this whole recovery thing has been a bit of a journey for me, actually. I now have managed about a bit more than 10 and a half years of consecutive recovery, which is pretty unbelievable, actually, when I think of it. You know, I saw a girl outside a meeting last night who I could identify with. She was, you know, just standing outside the meeting, kind of stunned. You know, I just remember when I first came in, I had to be put on these sort of medication because I just really fried my brain. I don't know. It was, the thought process was a bit distorted. So something meant something else, and then the response would be something else, which meant something else. And it was all this kind of code thing that was going through my head of, you know, and so it all kind of made sense, but nobody could have a conversation with me because I was kind of all over the place, and so I had to kind of slow down. You know, I remember in the beginning they put this elastic band around my wrist, you know, just sort of bring this, you know, idea of being here and now, you know, being in the moment. And I guess that was that was kind of like a completely new concept, like in a big way. It was a bit like being stoned on mushrooms or something like that. You know, it's stopping, you know, without going into some sort of vortex vacuum of despair of the past or freak out. You may have hypermania about what was going to happen or something. You know, I just couldn't stopping. You know, I'm here. I've got a roof over my head. I don't have to run for my life, you know. And all this kind of stuff was completely, completely new. It was my sister who phoned me. I'm from Canada. I'm like 10th generation Canadian. And my sister called up. She was in a 28-day program in Canada at the time, which was the most she ever did get. But she said this thing that they said there, which was about having one foot in the past and one foot in the future and pissing on today. And I could kind of get that. Towards the end of my using, I mean, it had gone through various phases to this sort of a bit of a crescendo of sort of doing all the festivals and sort of a traveling fiasco, basically, whereby I had about 23 people. I had a juice bar, which was all healthy, good for you. Everything was kind of a bit of a sort of a cover-up, you know. I had a place up in Camden, a smoothie bar, which was all healthy, good stuff, and you weren't allowed to sell booze on a Sunday. So I had really cleverly, as we are kind of resourceful, some of us, you know, particularly resourceful, worked out a way of doing the fresh juice with sort of half, on the verge of going rotten fruit, so I didn't have to pay much for it. And then trying to freeze the maximum amount of booze so it was solid, so it could be with a spoon, which meant it wasn't a drink. So then I would put a spoonful of this frozen liqueur-y thing into the juice, which would make it so that it was, you know, and this was a roaring trade, basically. Fucking roaring trade. Which which we then took around with a high voltage trapeze act around to all the festivals, funded by the smoothie bar, which had chocolate and things that you couldn't get, coffee, cappuccinos, you know, fresh fruit drinks and ice. I had an ice machine. And trying to do it under solar power. It was always this idea of trying to kind of be kind of right, you know. I found this guy that had, and also I was making elderflower cordial, which was before they started selling it at Sainsbury's, you know. So it meant that you could have this bit with sugar and just add water, and it was, you know, I could sell it pretty cheap, and it was a good, it was something that people couldn't get and all the rest of it. Anyway, the guy, I found somebody that was making this skunk leaf wine, which in my mind at the time wasn't booze or drugs. It's not that it was both, it was leaf. The two had cancelled each other out, you know what I mean? And it's funny you guys laughing because, I mean, as anybody else would sort of, wouldn't really sort of get that, but the, you know, it's something about this denial thing, you know. I sort of thought, if the drugs were sort of pure, they were like purer than air, you know. That sort of alcohol was like lighter and more spiritual than water. You know, water was like too heavy. You know, I've really sort of gone through to another dimension. I could sort of, I mean, it's taken a while to sort of see that, but, and then, oh my God. So it was, there's all different sort of phases to do with the kind of what you'd call using, you know. I mean, I never really wanted to, I never thought about it, actually, to be perfectly honest. I never really thought about was I using or wasn't I using. I just did, you know. My grandma was a nurse, and so were my aunts, and my mother was very young when she had me, and the whole neighborhood was on black bombers, you know, and everything was like squeaky, spanky, clean, and pressed and matching, and, you know. You know, brand new shiny car, you know, everything was sort of looked the part. And I guess in order to sort of keep it all going, it was kind of, yeah, fueled with, you know, my father, I grew up in Canada, and we, I guess, you know, sort of in retrospect, both of my parents had come from, both of their fathers had been alcoholics. So they were kind of, they were sort of trying to control it, you know, or something like that. But they probably may well have been. It made for a very tense, angry kind of place, basically. And I was the eldest of five. There was a lot of tragedy. I mean, sort of, I didn't realize that until, well, you know, just actually in the last couple of years, you know, it was kind of really quite a tragic upbringing. There was a lot of life death things, you know. Like, I grew up what I always thought was Mideast, but it's actually Midwest, and it's like the edge of the Midwest, which is just this fucking windy tornado that just goes and goes and goes, you know. There's like nothing there, and the train didn't even stop, you know, and it was on its way to Chicago, and I would go anywhere with anybody, just get me out of here, you know. And I did leave quite soon, actually. I don't know, there was always this, there was a lot of death, you know, there was a real lot of like sort of life death stuff, you know, where I'd sort of, I suppose I've been in a situation where I've been too responsible too young and for things I couldn't really control, like, you know, saving another child's life and things like that, or not saving another child's life. You know, and things, and so I think I thought if I was really, really good, and I was always really grateful for everything, for that I had two arms and two legs, and that I, you know, that I for the simple things, you know. I mean, I sort of grew up, I was always grateful for, like, for sort of nature and the clouds and the birds and the, you know, and all that sort of a thing, and everything that was me. And I think I sort of thought if I tried to be good. My mother got excommunicated from the Catholic Church for having me, and the family was really Canadian, you know, kind of had given the land and cleared the land and dragged the stones and built the church, and it was these really old, couple of hundred year old churches, and there was my mother excommunicated, and there it was because my fault. So I'd have to sort of go up to the cathedral, you know, and get it like a blessing. So everybody would know that, you know, I was the heathen in the church. And so I was constantly trying really hard to pray and be good and write letters and do worthy types of things, you know. And it was, I now sort of see, you know, the whole thing was really messed up. And it wasn't anything to do with me, actually. And I had no control over things like life and death. You know, I could pray as hard as I liked, and I couldn't change circumstances or how life was or anything like that, you know. So I suppose, and I played a lot of music. I played probably regularly about 6 hours a day, and I kind of, because I was the oldest of this huge bunch of kids, like 23 kids, and like from the age of 4, and no adults around, you know, I was sort of overly responsible and didn't really want to be. And so there were always all these kids trying to sort of following me around, and I was having to look. So as soon as I'd do something, then they'd all copy it. So I'd have to change it. So I was constantly, as soon as somebody was doing something, I'd have to do the opposite. Or, you know, I'd have to find something else all the time. I still am quite like that, you know, quite anti-fashion, and yet I end up working in the fashion industry, you know. But anyway, I'm sort of going off on a tangent. The using thing, I suppose the first thing I probably used was music. I played music obsessively, you know, kind of. And then also it was the 70s, and the most unhip instrument that you could play. What do you think it would be? It was the accordion. So I played Stairway to Heaven on the accordion in front of the like 400 people. It's got all the parts of it and everything, you know. And it was just because it was, you know, I was kind of a bit, I was kind of doing the good church things that you had to do to sort of be able to get out of the house and, you know, smoke cigarettes, you know, or things like that. Or, you know, whatever else would be going on around the back of the church. But music, cards, I really played a lot of cards, you know, gambling cards, and all that sort of thing. It was on a music trip, actually, that I had my first drugs. And it was, I guess, I'm not quite sure sometimes the sequence of the events, but I was quite bright, I guess, and I had accelerated at school, and so by the time I was 10, I was in with 11-year-olds. When I was 11, I was in with 13-year-olds, and when I was 13, I was in with like 16-year-olds and hanging out with 17-year-olds. So I was always too small to be playing sports properly, but kind of quite bright, you know, could sort of, and didn't want to be the browner, you know, sort of always having to downplay myself in a sort of a way. But it was on one of these school trips, and I was 13, that somebody gave me some purple microdot, which was just tiny. And I won all of the awards for the whole fucking province, you know, completely stoned on acid, playing the accordion, great strange personality, and all this sort of stuff. But I was tripping for sort of 3 days. And then there was sort of funny other, not so funny things happened. There was a couple of other kids that were sort of starting to shoot up, like milk. There was the milkman or peanut butter or anything anybody could find, and smack. And I was like 13, and I just swore that I would never do that. Like, there was this guy called Ruben who I thought was just great, had a motorbike, been to India, you know. Sort of on the back of his motorbike going to the pineries, and he's dropped just a tiny bit of gear. It was, you know, China White or something like that, apparently, in the sand, and scrambling around like a dog. And I thought, I never ever want to be that, you know, dependent on something. Although I had started smoking cigarettes at about the age of 8, cigarette butts. So the thing was to sort of get the butt. Well, get the matches first of all, from the shop, lie about the shop, and then sort of get chewing gum off the street, you know, sort of pulling the stones out of the chewing gum and trying to chew the gum and smoke a cigarette at the same time. You know, it's kind of to be like a man, or I don't know what it was, like to be tough, or, you know, don't wear a coat in the middle of winter, you know, and stuff like that. Just to show that you're, you know, tough. And it probably was pretty tough, actually, as well. So I really tried to not do any, I really did try to not do any drugs. I'd have sort of some hash in my pocket. I just like the smell of it. But I did actually smoke it. I mean, but I don't know why, but this denial thing, you know, booze. I liked, you know, sort of spirits. And for me, you know, straight up scotch was dry. So a drink would have been in a tall glass with ice and an umbrella. That would have been a drink. But if it was dry, it sort of didn't really count. So, you know, it's this kind of denial stuff that, did I drink in the morning? Well, absolutely not. But there was no difference between the morning and the night. You know, it sort of just was all one big blur. So I could hand in my heart say, no, I didn't drink in the morning. Because in my mind, there was, it just was all the same, you know, no. And it's this denial that that I have to be really vigilant about, and that's why I come to the meetings and get this therapeutic value of one addict helping another. You know, the identification, because I can like miss it myself. You know, my sister, who was the one that passed the message of recovery to me, that was it. Like, that was her sort of chance. And then what's happened is since then, it's kind of like that crack in the wall is kind of, and she's got a wet brain. You know, she's a year younger than me. You know, permanent brain damage. And you know, it can happen. It could happen to me, you know, sort of pulling funny faces until the wind blows and it stays like that, you know. It's kind of, you know, I don't want to chance it. You know, I've come really way, I've gone way past the line. I've lost a brother. I've lost too many people, you know, and really. So, well, coming here, you know, has been a chance. And anybody that's new around, I would say, give yourself a chance, you know. Really, you got no idea. I can remember when I first came out of that first treatment center, they said you had to make a list of things that you wanted or something. And I thought, well, I had done the step four thing. I was in primary for 10 months. I mean, I really hated it. I really hated it. Really. And I was on medication as well that first year or so. So, and I sort of needed to be on the medication. So, I mean, if some people do need to be, they need to be. I had taken such a mixture of pharmaceuticals and booze and all kinds of drugs, and I was a mess. You know, it fried my brain, basically. I mean, I was lucky that it was a gradual sort of, sort of getting back in some sort of alignment, you know. So that fake it to make it, you know. I sort of got the Racing Green catalog and decided I was going to be this horsey girl. No more black. you know, God became, you know, did a 9-to-5 secretarial office job. I'm an accountant, actually, so straight, you know, everything comes out nice, zero. oh dear. The giving yourself a chance and that being in there, and I remember, I just remember that little list, and I thought, clean and serene. I'd sort of heard that. So I put that I wanted to be clean and serene. Peace of mind. I really had to really think about it. Peace of mind. I thought that sounded like a good thing. But these kind of things I had no concept of, to be perfectly honest with you. I didn't really want anything. I kind of knew what I didn't want. But there was nothing I did want. You know, I really was that in that sort of a state, you know. It was like I'd been sort of sucked into this fucking hellhole. You know, vacuum hellhole. And I just wanted to go to the treatment center, basically. And And at the very end, I can remember half writing the sentence of wanting to do something creative. And I can still remember writing it. I was like cringing and like, oof, as I was sort of writing it, like, how dare I sort of think to do something like that. I sort of failed art at the age of 7, you know, because I painted everything black. And so that was it. I was maths and sciences from there on in. So, and now, you just wouldn't believe it. I mean, I do have a creative life, actually. I have a creative lifestyle, and I supply stuff to other people who are creative, you know, sort of ideas. And I don't know what's the time here. Okay, so I've got, 15 minutes more? Okay. Slow down. Yeah, I do get a bit like a runaway train, actually, then. All sorts of accidents happen, you know. I remember my husband said I was a bit like a dog with a bone, you know. Sort of go after something and then sort of don't let go. And yesterday I got into this rose bush I've been looking at for the last 3 years. And absolutely, and it's about, I've lived in the same place 27 years. So this rose's thorns are like that, all over, sort of strategically in between its branches, you know, so I'm completely cut up by roses. So some things haven't changed. I'm still hurting myself. But it's not until afterwards, it's only today, just as I sit here, I'm thinking, shit, I'm kind of aching all over the place, and it's because of this, because I wouldn't just stop or put on a pair of gloves or anything like that. Accidents. Actually, it was funny when Eddie said abstinence. I thought you said accidents. And it's that, the accidents that didn't happen. You know, the accidents that did happen, lots. Why I would be here and somebody else wouldn't be. I would say, I had a couple of sponsors to start with, and then they didn't really work out for one reason or another. And then I got Pauline, who's my sponsor, and she's great. She's just really... was right for me. I couldn't do anything too complicated. I couldn't understand the text or anything. Like, the steps, I couldn't do this. I've got to say, I did do the steps in the treatment thing, but I had to wait a little bit till I could do the steps. Step two for me went, I'd come out of the treatment center, took my Jetfire with the turbocharged engine, 62 Jetfire, decided to drive it from Paddington to Cookham to the mechanics with no brakes to get the brakes fixed, and I just did a step two, you know, that God would look after me. I'd hand the whole thing over, and I got in an accident, or that sort of, you know, the step for me went, you know, would it be God's will? As I got to the intersection at Tottenham Court Road, was I going to go to the dealers, which was up towards Hackney, or would it be God's will that I would go to the meeting? You know, that sort of thing. So I needed to really get, you know, I could sort of twist things around. I couldn't have cash in my pocket when I first came around. You know, cash equaled drugs instantly. It was just instantly. So I had to get a job where I got paid by a check and it went into the thing. Because I remember I sold balloons for VE Day at the park. And I was clean at that time, but it was just literally, the cash would just go straight to drugs, not even calculating it. That was just, so I couldn't, that was me. I couldn't have cash at first. I didn't have any booze around the house in case anybody dropped by. I didn't have to have the dealer's number to see how he was doing. I didn't have to take any food around to the dealer's dog or anything like that, you know, like I used to have to do to try to get preferential treatment, you know, so I'd sort of be able to get or whatever. You know, oh God, it wasn't. I sort of did it to—I did it practically to death, I guess you could say, really, and beyond. So the recovery after doing the steps, as I say, Pauline, she's just been gentle. You know, come to the meeting, one person at a time is speaking. You know, it's not all tricky. You know, it's, I need it to be really simple. Really, really simple, you know. I needed to stop this kind of things getting this meaning that, which is something else, and they said that, which is a this, that, and it's inside out, backwards, you know. I needed to really get to the basic things. I'd get my meeting list, I'd go to the meetings, I'd check it out, like I sort of see it like a skeleton, you know. Which are my meetings for the week? These are my main, I need to do 3 meetings a week, pretty much. So I've done my 3 meetings a week, which are my skeleton meetings, or at the very least 2. And then maybe some other sort of party meetings. Not exactly, but, you know, or I might sort of meet friends after or something like that. or before. So what? I've had lots of different types of experience with this. And it's a journey. It's that thing that people talk about it being a journey. You know, it's change. I wanted to change. Well, it's always changing. You know, and that's good. That's great, actually. As long as I can sort of kind of go with the flow and stay clean. You know, things are like working out really good for me. You know, I've got, I mean, just can, I can do it. I've got a life beyond my wildest dreams. You know, I've got, you know, I ended up, but I sell, okay. Okay, I've got 4 minutes left, so I'm going to talk about the kids. I've got 2 children. 10 minutes left, okay. Yeah, I've got my children were 6 and 7 or so when I came into recovery. So sadly, they did really go through some of the awful neglect, which was pretty much mostly what that was. And it was actually on account of my daughter. I remember seeing a look on her face on the stairs, and it was like, I really wanted to be a good mum, you know, and I wanted to have sort of 3-course meals and make cakes and go to the country and stuff like that. And I can just remember going out to my friend's farm where we'd always been going, and I wanted to have a nice few days with the kids, and I spent the whole fucking day inside the room, couldn't get away from the drugs, looking at the kids outside. Really nice day, really nice place. They had sort of rare breed farm animals, and where was I? The whole weekend went by, and I couldn't get away from the room and the drugs. And I can remember seeing my daughter's face on the stairs, maybe sort of shortly after, and she looked like she was there. She was 7 years old, looking like she was 100, you know, in her eyes. And I just, something about that shudders down my spine. I thought, I really have got to do something about this. But I couldn't have done it myself. Luckily, I had my friend who I went to the farm. She's probably really codependent. And I think they thought that I would be able to go to this. They took me to this psychiatrist who sent me to this treatment center. And I used to be the one that used to score the drugs for parties and stuff. I knew where all the drugs were to get everything. So I think she sort of thought I was going to go get myself sorted out. We'd make sure we'd only have 3-4 glasses of champagne. And then, you know, can you get us some ease as well? But anyway, so she came, picked me up, and took me to this place. But at that point, I had got myself to totally isolated. And then it's been the friends in the meetings, in the fellowship, actually. I found with the first 5 years, I was like a bit like a robot. Didn't want to lose my kids, so I was kind of pretty much doing it for the kids, and I thought, I'll just do it by the rules. I was grateful, I had all my commitments, I had sponsees, and when I was 5 years, I relapsed. And what I now know, not everybody has to relapse, and most people don't get back. And how the likes of somebody stubborn and unwilling to every single inch of my flesh for like a year and a half coming back to the meetings was not good, you know, really. I mean, and now I do willingly come, but, you know, I never want to be in that sort of situation where, what's the cravings, isn't it? You sort of get the craving back, and it's, you know, and all that sort of stuff. I don't get those cravings anymore. If I get something that's kind of painful, it's never the same. It's never to the point that I have to go and obliterate myself completely, you know. You know, life is good. Life is really good, but my daughter now, I remember when I was about a year, and she said, you know, when you came into recovery, I felt like I came into recovery. And it's like, the kids didn't know anything different. They had lost a daughter as well, so their younger sister had died as well. So what our life has completely changed from that sort of black, dead kind of a place that we were in, which is what it was like with the whole using thing. You know, it sort of started off really glamorous and fun and crazy, but it ended up, you know, with me with an aversion to water, couldn't brush my teeth. My teeth were all fucking rotten out of my head. I stank, you know, sitting in one place in the middle of the, you know, behind the door, through the crack of the door, by the thing of the window, with one of those night lights, kind of half arsely praying, sort of counting out the money, how long would the money last? I couldn't imagine living without using, you know. And now, my children have both graduated from university, doing things that they're really happy to do, creative, interesting. Me, I, you know, it's like a joke, my life, actually. I don't want to sort of sound like I'm bragging, and I'm not going to brag, but I've got a lot I could be bragging about, you know. No, I mean, really, I've got an amazing life, you know. I've got a lovely garden, you know, Notting Hill Gate, where I've got roses I can sort of chop myself to bits on, with lots of flowers still coming up all the time. And, you know, sort of a gorgeous garden. I've got a market stall with stock, with interesting stuff. I sell antique handbags. They're interesting. I've got an atelier in Paris where I'm making stuff. I sell stuff to Les Grands Marques in Paris, the big bag designers for prototype and design. I do exhibitions in art galleries in Paris. My medium is bags. Plastic bags. Old plastic bags. I mean, I've got a nice flat in Paris, you know, and here I am, you know, having sort of slightly sunburnt myself and being asked to do this nice chair and with some familiar faces and some faces that I've never seen, and even maybe the tape, we'll hear what the tape sounds like, but if it goes to somebody in some remote place or other, that, you know, this fellowship is everywhere. It's amazing, you know. And I don't know if anybody could identify with any of the madness stuff, but I keep trying to make it more not so sort of, I used to sort of embellish on the truth, but I mean, the truth is larger than life, has been actually in a lot of ways, you know. But I don't have to kind of tone myself down these days either. You know, I don't have to kind of, I don't have to like bury myself or what they hide your light under a bushel. You know, you can actually come out and be me, you know, and I love to see the transformation of addicts, you know. It's amazing, you know. All that crap can really be transformed into like the most amazing, wonderful stuff, you know. Alchemy, I think it is, or something like that. But I didn't mention anything about higher power. It always scares me. But I get it sort of here, and I kind of do it anyway, but I never try to define what it is or anything, because as soon as I think I have it, sort of poof away, like trying to catch a fairy, it sort of disappears, and I land flat in my face, so I don't know. I'm just glad to be here. Thanks, you guys, for asking me.